and move swiftly on to Lord Loughborough, who of course needs no introduction, but I shall give one briefly. He combines a brilliant practice at the bar and in the field of human rights and public law, as well as working as a peer on the Joint Committee of Human Rights. And at this particular moment, there's something particularly relevant to the topic he's going to speak about today that he is doing or engaged in, and that is his ongoing appointment as one of the seven commissioners appointed by the coalition government to investigate the creation of a British Bill of Rights. He's not going specifically or necessarily to speak on that topic this afternoon. The paper that you've got, you will see, addresses the question of the European Court of Human Rights and concerns that arise in relation to it from a British perspective. But it may be that, or it may not, we will see that he can be drawn more broadly on the topic of human rights in the United Kingdom and the question of a Bill of Rights. Lord Leicester.
Thank you very much. What I'm going to try to do is speak for probably 10 or 15 minutes and leave time for you to ask me questions or express your opinions, because at this time of day, that's much less boring than my speaking to a paper which you can all read. But just so I know the knowledge base and bias of the group, I would be interested in asking you a question, and I'll give you notice of it now when I say something else, which is, what do you consider to be the most important provision in the Human Rights Act? You'll have just about a few minutes to think about that, while I meanwhile say, as I should, how delighted I am to speak to the Public Law Project Conference yet again, and I'm particularly glad to do so under the sponsorship of Herbert Smith in this glorious palace, and of my own chambers. It reminds me historically of the particular reasons that I will not now go into as to why my chambers and Herbert Smith had a strange connection when I first came to the bar at a time of race discrimination. Which provision of the Human Rights Act do you consider to be the most important? Anybody? Yeah.
Requirement on public bodies to act compatibly with the Act.
Section 6. Anyone else?
Privacy, it's very important given the sort of trend of invasion of privacy.
Anybody else?
Section 3.
Pardon?
Interpretive duty. Duty to interpret, read any words.
I can't hear,
Section 3.
Section 3, an interpretive obligation. Anybody else?
Section 4.
Okay. Well, I will just say something which it's worth saying to a group of public law practitioners, which you wouldn't normally hear. I spent 30 years getting the Human Rights Act and introduced a couple of private members' bills, and one of them copied something out of the New Zealand bill that I found to be extraordinarily boring. There's a provision in there which requires the Attorney General to certify whether, in her opinion, legislation is or is not going to be compatible with the international covenant. And I wrote this into my bill and thought it was incredibly boring. And so did Parliamentary Counsel, who drafted the Human Rights Act. He found it amazingly boring as well. And it has turned out to be the most important provision in the Human Rights Act, Section 19, and the reason is because it is that provision which ensures that the obligation to secure and give effect to human rights is not confined to courts and lawyers in individual cases. It is extended to the political branches of government, and the ministers and their civil servants, as well as Parliament, are all animated by the practical operation of Section 19, read with the work of the Joint Committee on Human Rights. So I mentioned that at the beginning because it's important to a group of practitioners from our legal profession to emphasize that there is more than case law and legal cases to securing the effective compliance with human rights. The problem about the Human Rights Act, the political problem, was that it was introduced by a liberal Labour or Labour-Liberal conspiracy to get it through quickly as the easiest measure of constitutional reform, echoing the rights and freedoms in the European Human Rights Convention. And the reason why that created a political problem is because the people, just as they were never consulted about the right of petition that was introduced in 1966, they were never fully engaged in the passage of the Human Rights Bill. And so, although it is the darling of the legal profession, of all of you, and probably also of many judges, it is not the darling of most others, as you probably know. It is not the darling of the media, especially the tabloids, but not only. It's not the darling of a substantial body of opinion within the Conservative Party, and it doesn't have the kind of political legitimacy that a written constitution has in many common law and civil law countries. When the coalition government was formed, a compromise was struck between the two parties, my lot, the Liberal Democrats, being firmly European in human rights terms and committed to further constitutional reform to build upon the Human Rights Act, and the Conservatives being more sceptical about the role of the European Court and the role of the Human Rights Act. And the compromise was, as Philippa has said, to set up a commission composed of nine of us, a neutral chair, distinguished retired civil servant, and then four appointed by Mr. Clegg, myself, Helena Kennedy, Philippe Sands, and former judge Sir David Edward, and four appointed by Mr. Cameron, three other Queen's Counsel, Martin Howe, Anthony Spate, Jonathan Fisher, and a retired political scientist, Dr. Michael Pinto Duchinski. Not really a very representative group of anything except the male-dominated legal profession. And it is our task to attempt to see whether there is a case for a British Bill of Rights for the United Kingdom. There's a consultation in progress which will end on the 11th of November, and I would hope that everyone in this room in one way or another would respond to the questions in the discussion paper which we published some time ago, and they are: do you think we need a UK Bill of Rights? What do you think a UK Bill of Rights should contain? How do you think it should apply to the UK as a whole, including England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland? And are there any other views you'd like to put forward at this stage? Please reply to those questions in any way you think is appropriate. The other function we have been given is to contribute advice to the government on the reform process of the Strasbourg Court, the so-called Interlaken process. Next month, the United Kingdom has the presidency of the Committee of Ministers of the Council of Europe, and they have 6 months in which to muster sufficient support among the member states, among the 47 member states, to carry out much-needed reform in Strasbourg. One of the things that we have been able to do is to publish a letter of advice about the kind of reforms that we ourselves think would be welcome. And there's a separate letter written by our chair which contained a lot of other ideas that we have not discussed or agreed upon but are there floating around. The court is, of course, in a state of crisis. And it matters to you and me because if the court really does die or just lapse into a permanent decline, It means that the best international human rights court in the world is not going to be able to function properly. It means, too, that it won't be a source for ourselves in this country. It means that there will not be effective European supervision across the 800 million individuals that make up the 47 member states, including the four common law states. At the moment, there is a backlog of 150,000 cases, increasing by at least 20,000 a year, a very large proportion coming from Russia, the Ukraine, and Turkey. One of the practical problems is how one can clear the backlog and how one can have a court able to concentrate on really important cases, whatever that means, and not to have to deal with really trivial cases, whatever that means. Another very important practical problem is how to get a judiciary qualified to pass judgment on the national laws, practices, and case law of the member states. Interrights, an NGO that I am part of, some years ago, Stephen Sedley and I and a group of other judges produced a report on improving the quality of candidates and judges on the Strasbourg court. That remains a very pressing problem. Sir Nicholas Bratzer, the British president now, will go at the end of next year, as will some of the ablest and most experienced judges on the court. Their places have to be filled if we are to continue to have a court of the stature that is needed. Under some pressure, it has been decided to set up a vetting committee to look at candidates for the court and advise the politicians in the committee of in the Parliamentary Assembly as to whether they think the candidates are appropriate or not. However, because there is zero growth in the budget of the Council of Europe, no new money, and because there's therefore no resources for this committee, they don't have the money even to fly the candidates from their own states for an interview. So the vetting committee is deciding whether they think somebody is worthy of high judicial office on the basis of their purely paper qualifications. I know of no senior job in the world where advice is given purely on the basis of that without an interview, but that is where we now are. There is therefore a critical problem about how to improve that. In some of the member states, they are sending forward candidates. This is not an ageist remark, I don't think. Candidate age 30, who immediately has a baby, and then is expected to be a full-time member of the court, and has had no prior judicial experience, to quote one recent and controversial example. And yet that judge is meant to be passing judgment on whether national parliaments, courts, or governments have or haven't breached the convention. So the first question to do is what to do about the backlog, what to do about enabling prioritisation of cases, what to do about preventing future continuing overload, what to do about the quality of judges. I hope those of you who are interested might apply to be judge when Nick Bratzer retires, because we advertise it and so on. These are all burning issues. There's another range of issues which are of a more political or jurisprudential kind, and they are to do with fears expressed by some that the Strasbourg court or our own courts are guilty of activism, by which they mean violating the separation of powers by indulging in lawmaking instead of judicial decision-taking. And this involves quite strong pressure in some way to clip the wings of the Strasbourg court or of our own court. And one of the issues that the commission I'm on has to look at is whether there is indeed overreach by the Strasbourg court or by our own courts into the political branch's spheres. That whole argument turns on, if you like, the conflict between the literal and purposive interpretation of law and what is meant by subsidiarity. And it has been brought to a head by the prisoners' voting rights case of Hearst. The prisoners' voting rights case was meant to be implemented when judgment was given about 6 years ago, and the United Kingdom has always had a very good reputation for abiding by final judgments against the UK in accordance with Article 46 of the Convention. The previous government, unfortunately, led by Mr. Straw, unfortunately, did nothing whatever to abide by the judgment for 5 years, but bequeathed it as a poison chalice to the coalition government. The coalition government was minded to do something about it when one section of the Conservative Party made a tremendous fuss. There was a debate in Westminster Hall, largely attended by those who were anti the European Court and in favour of parliamentary supremacy. The result of that has been that there has been no legislation brought forward to implement the judgment. That gives great pleasure and comfort to Russia, that is able to point to the United Kingdom as an example of flouting the rule of law, which they themselves would like to do as well. And the state of play on the prisoners' voting rights is that the Strasbourg Court, because of another pending case in the Grand Chamber, has indicated that the UK must introduce not a draft bill, but an actual bill within a defined timescale. All of that, it has created a very fissile environment, as you will have read, and you will have seen also the controversy about Maya the Cat and the difference of opinion between the Home Secretary and the Justice Secretary and the Prime Minister. All of that is part of the political background. In the advice that we have given, we have made some recommendations which you can read in my paper. And if you look, for example, at page 10, 11, 12 onwards, I'm not going to go through them now, but I think it will be much more fun if you ask me questions I can't answer. So I will therefore now stop and turn into an extremely boring and discreet person. My first question, or maybe none.
Come, do we really have no questions? This is a great opportunity to try and embarrass Lord Leicester.
Yes.
Who's in a very delicate situation. Tom.
I'll have a go at embarrassing Lord Leicester. Lord Leicester, you talked about the fact that the Human Rights Act suffers from a crisis of legitimacy because of the way it was conceived and enacted. The questions that your committee has posed as part of its consultation are, firstly, should we have a Bill of Rights? Do we need a Bill of Rights? And the second question is, what does a Bill of Rights contain? Now, I suggest that there's a missing question there, and the question that's missing is the question that's the most important question, which is that if we should have a Bill of Rights, how should we go about conceiving and enacting such a measure in this system? And in answering that question, I urge you not to take refuge in question number 4, which is, if you have any further comments to add to your response, you can add them here.
Thank God for Tom Hickman. God, you're really boring people. The first question really is, what is a Bill of Rights for the United Kingdom that we don't have already? What we have already is, of course, the common law and the devolution legislation, which embodies the Convention rights, and the Human Rights Act, which some would say is an enforceable Bill of Rights already. So when one talks about a Bill of Rights for the United Kingdom, does one mean tearing up the Human Rights Act, as Theresa May would like, or does one mean doing what Gordon Brown's government suggested, which was to have a Bill of Rights there and a curious floating thing here, which is called a Bill of Rights and Responsibilities, but creates no rights and imposes no responsibilities. That was the Mr. Brown's solution to the problem. Or does one take the Human Rights Act and do you amend it? Do you add any new rights to it? Or do you have a kind of charter of rights which reenacts what is in the Human Rights Act and adds to it a right to administrative justice, a right, general right to equality, perhaps economic and social rights, but basically non-justiciable, as in South Africa and Ireland, for example, or not. There are a number of difficult choices in theory available. One of the basic problems that I have no clear answer to is how you can have a Bill of Rights for the United Kingdom and also have separate Bills of Rights for the countries of the United Kingdom, notably Northern Ireland and Scotland. Since we don't have a federal system, Scotland is not like Mississippi, and Northern Ireland is not like Connecticut, both of which, of course, have their own state bills of rights. And one of the things that public lawyers need to think much more clearly about than they have so far is what you would do to have a Bill of Rights for the United Kingdom, which is our terms of reference, and allow a dovetailing provisions for bills of rights in the different parts of the United Kingdom. To take the example that Conor Geertie knows better than I do, under the Good Friday Agreement, the idea was that the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland would adjust their systems in order to produce common values, common standards in the human rights area. The Republic didn't really do that, and in Northern Ireland, the Human Rights Commission spent 8 years in trying to define what were the special needs of the people of Northern Ireland that would justify a special Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland. Of course, the community is split between the Unionists, who don't want it at all, and the Republicans, who don't want to be part of the UK at all. And that is where we now stand. But imagine you could get a political consensus in the north of Ireland in favour of a Bill of Rights for Northern Ireland. Then how do you define my rights when I travel to Belfast? Do I get more rights even though I don't live or work there? And how then do you, as it were, do that legally? How do you do that in terms of definition or not? And how do courts and governments and parliaments make decisions within a non-federal system? If we had Gladstone's Home Rule all round, that would be a different matter. But we don't. We are a unitary state with devolved administrations and governments and courts. And so I'm not aware that any public lawyer, academic or practitioner, has produced any very clear, clearly thought-out ideas as to how to solve the federal question in a non-federal system and have this diversity of bills of rights, there being strong pressure from one part of the Northern Irish community, and it's growing in Scotland as well. This is one of the problems that my commission will have to answer. And by now you've forgotten the question that Tom Hickman asked. So are there any other questions?
In your introduction, when you asked us a question, you asked what we thought the most important part of the Human Rights Act was, and I'd be very interested to know what you think the least important part is. So I got this vision of you sitting around with your commissioners negotiating about what will be in a Bill of Rights and what won't be in. And if you had to jettison what we now have, what would you choose to jettison?
I wouldn't choose to jettison any part of it myself, because I think it's a very subtle and ingenious measure, And I like the fact that we are not bound by Strasbourg case law by way of stare decisis. I like the fact that the interpretive obligation is strong, but still, in the end, leaves breathing space to the legislature. I like the notion of a declaration of incompatibility, first suggested by Hirsch Lauterpacht in 1944 in a little book. I think it's a very ingenious way of reconciling the need for effective remedies with the need to respect the supremacy of Parliament. I don't believe any more in the strike-down power as something that would be likely to be politically possible in our Parliament. I like the way in which the definition of public authorities, unlike the Irish equivalent measure, allows our courts to develop, requires our courts to develop the principles of law and equity in accordance with the convention, rather than as under the Irish measure, this ludicrous idea that they can't do that, but have to give a declaration of incompatibility about Irish common law, which seems to me to stultify the whole thing. I like the way in which remedial orders have to be looked at by a joint committee of both houses. I like the way in which, thanks to the JCHR, ministers are called to account in legislating, and Parliament is much better informed in debates on legislation. And I like the fact that nothing in the Act is intended to take away existing common law rights and freedoms. So I think all of that is great. And I can think of very few additional rights that are lacking that you might put in. I say one would be administrative justice if it didn't cage the development of judicial review. Another would be a general right to equality, perhaps south of the border, economic and social rights, but with all the problems about justiciability and so on. But not much else. Some would say you must rebalance free speech and privacy to give greater protection to free speech, but then, of course, you've got to do that compatibly with convention case law.
Is it your view then that human rights protection will be enhanced at the end of the process that you're now embarked on, or is there a possibility that it won't be?
Well, I think that if one could get, Labour is committed to the Human Rights Act as it stands. The Liberal Democrats are committed to it as well. Liberal Conservatives are as well. If one were able to establish a wide political consensus among the main parties in favour of it or something very much like it, to give it political legitimacy, that I think would enhance the protection. I think there has been a cultural revolution in Whitehall and among public authorities as a result of it, but I think that this continuing attack on it by the tabloid media, and not only tabloids, and by one part of an important political party, and by ministers blaming it quite unfairly and even attacking our own judges, is very bad. It undermines the European rule of law and our own rule of law. So if the process in the end leads to more consultation, more understanding of how it works, whether it leads to further legislation or not, that, it seems to me, makes it not a waste of my time or others to lie upon the bed of nails.
Can I just ask a question about the adequacy of the consultation process that you're going through, bearing in mind the problem of the lack of society buy-in, exemplified through the response of the media, etc., and the current social problems we have, where you potentially have ostracised sections of the community. And potentially also a lack of respect for MPs through expensive scandals, etc. Is it adequate, do you think, for the consultation process to be put on a government website? And don't you think it might be a lot more legitimised if actually it had some more interactive, proactive people going into the community and actually finding what different communities actually wanted,
including potentially the older community who may not have the access to an online consultation process.
Absolutely. I hope the website makes it clear that the public consultation on the discussion paper is only the beginning of the process. We've already had about 300 responses to that, but they're mainly from individuals, and some of them, I suspect, are simply put up by NGOs to say the same thing. We've had no or very few feedbacks from institutions like government departments or the judiciary or local authorities and so on, trade unions, groups representing vulnerable people, and I hope that that will happen in writing by November 11, and I think you should help them. Well, I don't care what your views are, but it seems to me it's very important to get feedback. Once that has happened by the 11th of November, we are then committed to go to Scotland, go to Northern Ireland, go to Wales, go around the country and have face-to-face meetings. And Helena Kennedy, who is much better at that kind of thing than I am, is really leading the process of engagement of that kind. And we've got until the end of next year to do that. We have very few resources. I mean, the amount of money devoted to the Commission is very, very small. But we're very aware of the fact that we are 8 white men, 1 white woman, and we're hardly representative of, and 7 of us are Queen's Counsel, so it's not exactly a very representative group. That's not my fault, it's what the politicians eventually decided to do. But the good thing about that is that, on the whole, lawyers act more professionally than politically, I hope, and therefore, you know, there may be more common ground than you might think just by looking at our origins. But you're absolutely right. The key to the whole thing has to be a deliberative process. Indeed, one of the things we've been discussing is whether we should actually engage an expert in polling, not just focus group polling, but polling an informed section of the public. Almost like holding a referendum. That's a very difficult thing to do because you'd have to agree, first of all, on the right information and the right questions. But what your point is crucial. There has to be as much outreach as we can to give us any kind of credibility.
Thanks very much.
I'm afraid, see there's another question there, but I am afraid we are now running quite far over, so I'm going to have to bring this session to an end. Thank you very, very much, Lord Leicester.